It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The U.S. Justice Department reported that the country's state and federal prison population rose 2.1% from 2021 to 2022. The state of Wisconsin saw a similar increase. That may not seem like a lot, but it reversed a trend of 10 straight years of declining prison population rates and incarceration rates across the country. And the latest numbers still show significant racial disparities. Wisconsin, in particular, remains the state with the largest disparity between black and white male incarceration. We're checking in on the recent changes in prisons and the impact it can all have on our communities, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think we saw that longer-term decline and then a recent bump in the latest numbers in incarceration? How do you want to see our justice system approach things like sentencing and imprisonment? Have you or a loved one been in the prison system yourself? Share your experience, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Jason Roby is an assistant professor in the School of Criminal Justice at the University at Albany SUNY. He did his graduate and doctoral work at UW-Madison, where he researched mass incarceration and racial disparities. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jason, we talked to you last fall about why incarceration rates had been declining for that long period. Can you remind us again what we know about what was driving that over that last decade?
Yeah, so really the decades-long decline in incarceration rates has really been driven by shifts, you know, throughout the criminal justice system in the composition of our nation's population, in crime rates among individuals, particularly youth, and in the political landscape as well. These have all been contributing factors to driving down incarceration rates in the United States.
And maybe the bigger story is, if we dig a little further back, the huge increase in incarceration rates starting, depending on how you slice it, I think the early 1980s. Can you talk about what we saw starting around then-ish?
Yeah, so starting in the late 70s, early 80s, and into the 90s, we saw a really significant increase in the number of people in prison in the United States. By some estimates, about a sevenfold increase in the number of people in prisons, and disproportionately locking up young black men in particular in the United States, really launching the United States into the highest incarceration rate in the entire world. And that was driven by a lot of different factors. Part of it was a real increase in crime that occurred in the 70s and 80s in particular. And there was also sort of the tough on crime era, is what it's known as, you know, a shift in policy around the United States, hoping to lock up more people and for longer periods of time.
Now, let's look at these latest numbers. It takes a while to complete these surveys, I gather. We've got a survey from the end of 2022 showing, after that decade of declines, the number of people incarcerated going up instead, about 2%. Now, when you look at that, you say, well, that could be a blip in the midst of this long-term trend, or it could be a reversal. What do you make of this particular big data point?
Yeah, so first I want to emphasize, like you said, that this increase in 2022 was rather small and was also only an increase relative to 2020 and 2021, which were, you know, very anomalous years. So like many areas of our society, the prison system and court systems were drastically affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. So in 2020, courts in the United States and virtually every state completely closed for weeks or even months. And when they resumed, they were often conducting court on Zoom. And so these were causing significant delays and backlogs that caused, in 2020, there were 200,000 fewer people in prison by the end of 2020 than there were in 2019, which is the largest single year change of the prison population in recorded history. So in many ways, 2020 and 2021 were anomalies and not exactly the best, you know, comparison for us to make. And so a lot of us researchers were really waiting for these 2022 statistics to be released as our first glimpse at what the new sort of post-COVID normal would be for our nation's prison system. And so for me, the better comparison to make is comparing these to 2019, mm-hmm. sort of the last, you know, quote unquote, normal year that we had. And so compared to 2019, the prison population in 2022 was about 15% smaller nationally and about 13% smaller in the state of Wisconsin.
So that would suggest that this longer term decline is still going on once we get past the very weird, as you say, years of 2020 and 2021.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can think of an analogy of, you know, comparing the unemployment rate, for example, right? That spiked tremendously in 2020. But, you know, in terms of understanding the long term trends of unemployment in the United States, you know, maybe not the best year to make comparisons to in some ways.
So what is happening, again, accepting those couple of COVID years, what is happening that's leading us over this time to see this steady decline in the number of people incarcerated in the United States?
Yeah, so like I mentioned earlier, sort of briefly, there are several different factors, right? So crime rates in the United States are substantially lower today than they were 30 years ago, about 50 to 60% lower, depending on what type of crime you're talking about. And evidence suggests that the youth today in particular have even lower rates of criminal behavior, lower rates of alcohol use, and also lower rates of drug use than youth did 20 to 30 years ago. So it's not just that the overall crime rates are declining, but also that youth crime rates in particular are declining. There have also been notable shifts in the criminal justice system, particularly with respect to racial disparities. So racial disparities and arrest rates have declined significantly in the last 20 years, meaning that, you know, there are reduced disparities in the policing of in our country in general. And there's also some evidence to suggest that courts have become, less racially disparate in sentencing individuals to prison and how long they sentence people to prison. And lastly, I just want to touch briefly on politics here, right? Many researchers, journalists, and politicians have noted a persistent and growing, you know, bipartisan consensus that America's experiment with imprisonment went too far and needs to be reined in. And so there's really been a sort of bipartisan consensus for a number of years now that we need to reduce the prison population in the United States.
Jason Roby is with us, criminal justice expert at the University at Albany, talking about how many people are in prison in the United States, an uptick this year from the COVID years, but as you heard, a longer-term trend that sees fewer and fewer people incarcerated over time. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences in the criminal justice system. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Jason, I want to talk a little bit about the current prison population, seeing numbers showing more and more unprecedented numbers of seniors. Older people in prison as people in long-term incarceration age. And this is a big factor in funding for criminal justice. Those people living in there at older ages facing the same problems as anybody else as they age, a higher medical cost, things like that. What do you make of that? How big a problem do you see this?
Yeah, this is a significant problem in the United States prisons today. And it really has a couple of sort of driving factors. One, like I said, there are some differences in cohorts or generations within the United States and how much crime they committed while they were younger, but also how much they were exposed to sort of the peak of mass incarceration in our country. So the current, you know, generation of youth has very low crime rates and very low arrest rates and very low incarceration rates. But the generation that was sort of coming of age, entering adulthood during the sort of rise of mass incarceration was exposed to these really high incarceration rates, and as a result of that, have been continually exposed to incarceration throughout their lifetime, and particularly as they've aged into middle ages as well. And the other part of it is these long sentence lengths that the United States has, which is relatively unique on an international stage, in that, you know, about a third of all prisoners in the United States at the end of 2019 had been there for at least 5 years. And about 20% of them had been there for at least 10 years, right? And so we have sort of two problems. One is that, you know, we have an increasing number of older individuals being sent to prison relative to what we had 20 years ago. And we also have an increasing number of people aging while in prison as well.
And related, I think, to that, Jason, I've seen some stats here in Wisconsin and elsewhere saying a leading cause of somebody being sent to prison is for violating the terms of their release from prison, which might involve alcohol use, if that was stipulated as something you can't do after you are released from prison, or other drug use, things like that. How important is revocation of somebody who's been released from prison and has to go back in the numbers we're talking about?
That's extremely important. Nationally, I believe the number is about one third of all prison admissions in the United States are people who have been who are being revoked off of their parole. And so sometimes that is what's known as a technical violation, right? So somebody who's committed something that is not a crime necessarily, but is against the conditions of their release from prison. And sometimes it can be a new crime that occurs that is mm-hmm. is what ultimately results in them going back to prison. But it's a significant driver of prison populations in the United States today.
We're talking to Jason Roby, criminal justice professor at the University at Albany, about trends in incarceration, a recent uptick in prison population after the COVID years, but a long-term trend of declining numbers of people in prison. Coming up, we'll look at racial disparities in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? How do you feel about the way the U.S. handles incarceration? What impacts have you seen the prison system have, maybe on your own family or your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on that revocation issue we were just talking about? What leads someone back into prison for violating the terms of their release? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Jason Roby, assistant professor in the School of Criminal Justice at the University at Albany SUNY, graduate of UW-Madison, with us today for a look at incarceration rates, long-term decline, a little uptick in the most recent years after COVID. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Before we go to our callers, Jason, I wanted to talk to you about racial disparities, something you've studied here in Wisconsin, some of the biggest disparities in Wisconsin among states in the country. What are you watching lately?
Yeah, so, I mean, in Wisconsin has for a long time had the largest racial disparities in the United States in terms of incarceration rates, although they did come down a little bit in the last 20 years. From about 14-1 to about 9-1. So still a very large disparity in Wisconsin, but smaller than it had been 20 years ago. And this is sort of a trend we've seen nationwide for both men and for women, that the racial disparity in incarceration rates has continued to decline, but still has more room to decline further.
Let's go to our callers now. Jim is with us in Hartford. Jim, hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. I think more people should be locked up. If you look at the crimes that are going on the street on a daily basis, DAs are just letting multi-offenders go. Look at the Waukesha massacre, you know, at Christmas time, at a Christmas parade. He had multiple offenses. This is one example of several that come across the news where they're just not locking people up, especially people who have gun charges against them. They're found with guns and they just let them go. Well, you know, we're going to give them a second chance. And as far as racial disparity goes, I mean, the numbers have been proven that more blacks, even though they're more black people, do create more crimes. They're a minority of the population, yet they're a majority of the crimes that are committed. And a lot of them are black on black.
Jim, thanks for the call. Jason, let's start with Jim's first point. He wants to see more people incarcerated, effectively saying we're soft on crime and that's leading to more crime.
Well, so I mean, I think, you know, there's always the tendency to, you know, be fearful when things like that happen. And it's unavoidable that, you know, we can never erase crime completely from our society. And it's inevitable that sometimes we might make the wrong decision in letting somebody out. We also can't hold everybody who commits a crime forever, right? We have to at some point recognize that everybody we send to prison will one day come out of prison for the most part. And what do we do while they're in prison to try to help them or try to reduce the likelihood that they'll do that again? And for the most part, once somebody's been out of prison for 7 years is usual, the number of people you usually use, they're no more likely to commit a crime than somebody who's never been to prison in their life. So for the most part, for most people who are released from prison, they do end up, you know, making it back into a law-abiding life and refrain from committing crimes in the future. So there are always exceptions to any rule.
And Jim argues that more black people end up in prison because more black people commit crimes. What do we know?
So there are racial disparities in prisons can come from a lot of different places, right? So there can be underlying racial disparities in, you know, how many people commit crimes in different communities, or, and also, you know, how many people are arrested having committed a crime, and how many people are sent to prison having committed a crime. And what we see in regards to race is that there are disparities at every single level. But so one particular example that people have often used is for drug crimes in the United States. Rates of drug use in the United States are actually very similar for white individuals and for Black individuals, but Black individuals are much more likely to be arrested for that. And if they are arrested, they're much more likely to be convicted by a prosecutor and a judge. And if they're convicted, much more likely to be sent to prison. Right? And so these disparities can arise at any point along the way. And there are some real underlying racial disparities in crime rates at the outset, but these are sort of amplified by, you know, the various decision points along the way in the criminal justice system that make the disparities in the prison population much worse than the underlying, you know, differences in crime rates, which are relatively small.
Let's go back to our callers. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Mike?
Yeah, this subject matter kind of hits close to home. I have a family member, first-time nonviolent offender in a different state that's been, his sentence now is going on 14 years out of 15 years. He was denied multiple appeals, and from what his attorneys have told him through the process is the reason why, I don't want to get into his crime because that's a whole separate matter. I'm not justifying what he did, you know, did or didn't do, but essentially, how do you see in the political spectrum affecting prison populations if a judge or judges want to get elected and, quote, be tougher on crime, giving, you know, more stiffer penalties or longer penalties or more imprisonment in those areas?
Mike, thanks for the call. Do we know, Jason, if an election of justices or district attorneys or, you know, be hoping to be appointed to those posts influences a tough on crime attitudes for prosecutors and or judges?
Yeah, there is definitely some evidence to suggest that, you know, when judges know they have an election or a re-election coming up, they might, you know, change their sentencing a little bit. But in general, judges are relatively fixed is what we often see. You know, in order to become a judge in the United States, you have to, you know, have a number of years of criminal justice experience and a number of years as a prosecutor, a public defender, or some other type of legal profession within the field. So for the most part, most judges are relatively fixed in their decision making and don't change a whole lot in those decisions. But things like elections and re-election can shift their opinions as well. Although I would say that, you know, like I mentioned earlier, there is a growing bipartisan, you know, effort and consensus that we should be trying to reduce the use of prison and use alternatives to prison. And so I think more and more in recent years, that's likely less of a problem today than it was 10, 15 years ago.
Mike, thanks for that call. Jim joins us now in Watertown. Jim, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. So I served my time in Virginia, not in Wisconsin, but from stories I've heard, it's not that different. What I've got to say is a couple of things, really. One, when incarcerated, if you are a nonviolent, you know, somebody who was on the verge of being able to serve their time in a jail or but got sent to a prison, you are generally put in with the harder criminals because it is a calming factor for the dorms or odds or whatever you want to call them. So those people that are serving time there have to, you know, protect themselves, have to become something like what you're living with. Otherwise, you're going to have to defend yourself daily. The other part of this is, you know, for the recidivism part, I guess is what I'm talking about. And the other part of that is that you have nothing to fall back on when you get out. Nothing. You are sent out penniless, maybe, you know, for the most part penniless, to and expected to live a law-abiding existence. And if you're talking about the disparity between races, you take that same person and put them in a city where there are very few jobs, very few places even to buy food or, you know, clothing or whatever.
Jim, we're just about out of time. And thank you so much for sharing your story. Jason, Jim pointing toward a couple causes maybe of recidivism, that low-level nonviolent offender all of a sudden living among people who have committed more serious crimes and no support on the way out the door.
Yeah, thanks, Jim, for sharing your experiences. And just to reiterate, yeah, I think that's one of the key areas of trying to reform the criminal justice system today. And going back to our first caller and this idea of recidivism and why people commit crimes again, a lot of it has to do with the resources we do or many times don't provide to people who are coming out of prison that they might need in order to regain that life they want to have.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. In our last half a minute or so, Jason, what is the big open question for you as you watch for trends and how many people get locked up in the next year or two?
Yeah, I mean, my ultimate, you know, curiosity here is what's going to happen with prison admissions in particular. So prison admissions in 2022 were just under 500,000. The last time prison admissions were that low in the United States, you know, before COVID was 1992. And so do we continue to see, you know, people being sent to prison at lower and lower rates, or do we start to see things start to tick up again as, you know, violent crime and homicide in particular has sort of increased in the last couple of years? How will those things play out going into the future? That's my main curiosity.
Jason, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rob. It was an honor to be with you.
That's Jason Roby, assistant professor in the School of Criminal Justice at the University at Albany SUNY. He did his graduate and doctoral work at UW-Madison. He joined us today to talk about why incarceration rates have been going down in the long term, a blip up in 2022 after declining even more because of COVID. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Last week, the U.S. Department of Justice filed an antitrust lawsuit against Apple. The lawsuit alleges that Apple has stifled competition and innovation by making it difficult for iPhone users to buy or use non-Apple products, including things like gaming apps, digital wallets, or smartwatches. Wisconsin is one of 16 states that joined the U.S. Justice Department in bringing the case against Apple. Our next guest is a lawyer in the Wisconsin Department of Justice and a national expert in antitrust law. She's here to help us understand the ins and outs of the case and what's at stake for big technology companies and consumers as the government tries to crack down on monopoly practices in the technology industry. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a longtime iPhone user? Have you run into problems with being able to use your iPhone with non-Apple products like smartwatches or apps? You run into issues in your family if some of you have iPhones, others have Androids. What are you hoping to see come out of this lawsuit? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Gwendolyn Cooley is Assistant Attorney General at the Wisconsin Department of Justice and Chair of the National Association of Attorneys General Multistate Antitrust Task Force. Gwendolyn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. I'm pleased to join you.
I gave a very short summary. There's a lot more to this case. Can you give us a sense of the basic claim at the heart of this challenge to Apple?
Yeah, I think you actually summed it up very well. You know, our claim is really about how Apple has created a moat around its very profitable iPhone to keep people using the iPhone and not switch to Samsung or Android. And they didn't do that by being just a great product. What we allege they did is a number of things, right? You talked about watches, you talked about messaging. We also allege that they blocked super apps. Now, if you're like, what is a super app? If you're familiar with WeChat in China, it's essentially the one app to unite them all, right? It is a super app that is everything to all people. Okay, so Apple blocks those. But bizarrely, we allege that they allow them in China. So there's kind of a mismatch on why those are blocked here. Okay, that's one. You mentioned gaming, right? So we talk about suppressing mobile cloud streaming services. And there's a couple different ways they do that. One, the obvious one, if you're in a game and you need to, this is going to make me sound like I'm more experienced in gaming than I am, but if you're in a game and you need to buy a new skin, right, you're buying that through the Apple payment system, right? We also say that part of the reason why Apple blocked cloud streaming gaming systems is because that way you have to pay for the expensive smartphone that's going to have the processing speed to keep you using that. Because if you're just doing something that's in the cloud, that's processed elsewhere. It's not done on your local device. So you don't need the fancy phone. Okay. So that's two. Mm-hmm. We talked about messaging. That's three. Smartwatches, right? And the reason why smartwatches matter, right? If you've got an Apple Watch, and then you have to have an Apple iPhone. If you decide that you want to get the latest Samsung or Android device, or if there was a miraculous other competitor in the device category, and you wanted to get that new phone, your Apple Watch won't work with something that isn't an iPhone. So essentially, you're throwing that in the trash. And then those third-party digital wallets you mentioned, right? If you use tap-to-pay functionality with your phone, you can only do that on your phone through the Apple Wallet if you have an iPhone, which makes you locked in. You can tell I just had my iPhone in my hand. Makes you locked in to using your iPhone, because if you get a new phone, you get a Samsung, you get an Android, you've got to then upload all of that information, all of your financial information, all of your Ticketmaster tickets, all of that stuff then needs to be reloaded through a different device. So those are not the only ways that we allege in the complaint, but those are the main ways that we allege that they're creating that moat to keep people locked into iPhone.
And the court filing, written in normal human language, which I always appreciate in legal briefs, shares some talk internally and externally from Apple executives that suggests that they were very conscious of this and doing it deliberately, talking about how bad it might be if people could move back and forth between an Apple and, say, a Samsung device on the same app. How important a part of this case is it that Apple was doing this intentionally, trying to make the word is sticky, make their products more sticky and make it harder for people to use other stuff?
We certainly allege that stickiness is a very important part of this case. While we're not required to prove intent in monopolization cases, which is what you're talking about, it is useful, right? As you say, normal everyday humans want to know why someone is doing a thing. And that's part of monopolization here, right? We're saying they are doing this basket of conduct because they are trying to entrench their monopoly. They're trying to create that moat to keep people locked into the iPhone. So I think it's great that we were able to cite some direct evidence in the complaint. I'm glad that we were able to keep that public and let you have access to reading the whole thing. I agree. It's a well-written complaint.
Gwendolyn Cooley is with us from the State Department of Justice, chair of the National Association of Attorneys General Multi-State Antitrust Task Force, talking about a federal lawsuit that Wisconsin is joining in against Apple, saying they are leveraging their market power to make it harder for competitors, whether it's app developers, competing devices, or consumers to use things other than Apple products once they start using Apple products. It's an antitrust suit. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Gwendolyn, I can imagine, you know, a devoted Apple user who says, hey, I use their phone, I use their watch, I'm happy with how they function. So how are these practices hurting me? What would you tell them?
Yeah, I would say that there is definitely a consumer effect, right? Should we prevail, and of course we're enforcers, not regulators, so it will be ultimately up to the court in New Jersey to decide this. But what we're asking for is essentially allowing some options, allowing app developers to create ways for people to move their data to other phone systems more easily. We also want Apple to be prevented from undermining that cross-platform technology, like with messaging and smartwatches and digital wallets and all that things, right? We're really trying to not play whack-a-mole here. We're trying to get at that foundation of this conduct.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jay joins us now in Washburn. Jay, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess my question is if the lawsuit is based on any significant consumer complaints or if this is just from the states and the DOJ. And the reason I ask that is because I think most people buy products because they like the product type, and people buy Samsung or they buy Apple because they like Apple. If you go back to Apple 20 years ago, their motto was, it just works. So people start buying that. So is this significant consumer complaint, or is it just from the states and DOJ?
Jay, thanks for the call. Gwendolyn.
So that's an interesting question, right? So we generally bring cases because we think they're important to consumers. Obviously, iPhone has a 65% market share nationwide. So roughly speaking, that means that somewhere around 3.7 million Wisconsinites are directly affected by the allegations in this complaint. And that's great if they're happy with the Apple iPhone as it could be. But what we're saying is consumers should have those options. So think how happy one might be if these things were fixed, right? And that's, 3.7 million Wisconsinites being affected by that. That's something that I think is, you'd be hard pressed to find something in Wisconsin that's going to impact more consumers, because I think it impacts not just those folks who have an iPhone, but if you have an Android and you have the green bubbles in your text message chats with your iPhone users, right? Like that is a harm to competition that we see. So we are not saying that Apple isn't a good product. We're just saying we need to make sure that competition is preserved in this market.
Jay, thanks for the call. I want to talk about impact on what people pay for stuff. One argument I think from app developers is because of this effect of monopoly, the market share of Apple takes, I think it's a 30% cut of app purchases and in-app purchases, and Apple phones themselves have a decent markup. Is the hope that if these remedies that you're seeking are delivered in a court, that some of those costs would come down for the consumers themselves?
Yeah, I think that's brilliantly summarized. Yes, that is the hope, that the cost would come down for consumers themselves, ultimately, because if a court grants the injunction that we're asking for, that would mean that Apple would essentially have to open its black box to allow some of these more innovative products and to allow some more interoperability.
Gwendolyn Cooley is Assistant Attorney General at the Wisconsin Department of Justice and Chair of the National Association of Attorneys General Multi-State Antitrust Task Force. With us for a look at why Wisconsin and 15 other states have joined the U.S. Justice Department in a lawsuit against Apple that alleges the company is engaged in monopolistic practices, especially with the iPhone, that stifle competition and hurt both app developers and consumers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think that major technology companies like Apple and a lot of the other big names should be more heavily regulated to keep competition in the marketplace? Or do you think Apple earned their dominance by having popular products that outdo the competition? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Gwendolyn Cooley from the Wisconsin Department of Justice about why Wisconsin and 15 other states joined the U.S. Justice Department's monopoly lawsuit against the Apple Corporation. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had problems when you try to do the same stuff across platforms that include Apple products? Did you finally give up and buy an Apple product to solve that problem? Join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Gwendolyn, we hear other concerns about monopoly practices at other big technology companies. Do you see this lawsuit targeting Apple as part of a wider campaign?
Yes. The Wisconsin Department of Justice, uniquely unlike the U.S. Department of Justice, actually has sued the entire gamut, I would say, of big tech companies. Last fall, we sued Amazon for monopolization in both the seller and buyer market that we alleged raised prices even off the Amazon platform. We've sued Google twice, which might be confusing, but let me just explain. One case was the Google search case. That's that big case that you may have heard about also last fall that we went to trial for, and that is still pending. We are doing closing arguments for that one in May. And then this winter, we announced a settlement related to Google's in-app payments, right? The Google store. That settlement is still pending approval from the court. That one is for settlement is $700 million nationwide. Ultimately, a lot of that money will go directly to consumers, including Wisconsin consumers. The Facebook case, that one was a little bit less successful. We sued Facebook in, I'm going to say 2019 or 2020. I don't remember exactly when, but that one was to unwind the WhatsApp and Instagram mergers. That case, ultimately, we lost in the district court and on appeal. So, but we have definitely been taking a close look at big tech generally. I think part of the reason for that is that, right, it's important that there is no company, regardless of size, that is exempt from the antitrust laws, right? The size of a company is not an antitrust violation, right? Being a monopoly is not an antitrust violation. But it is when companies engage in these practices that we're extremely concerned. Now, that said, big tech is not the only concern that the state attorneys general have, and certainly not the only concern that our attorney general has, right? I, myself, for 8 years, if you include the investigation, led 42 states in investigation of the maker of the Suboxone drug, right? Investigation and ultimately litigation. We settled that case last June for $102.5 million nationwide, right? So big tech is extremely important. We want to make sure that we're keeping an eye on what they're doing and making sure that they're not stifling competition. But we are also looking at important things like drug industry, both generic drugs and name brand drugs. We have a case against pesticide manufacturers from their monopolization of the, I guess we call it the pesticides case, but it's really the crop protection chemicals. So including fungicides and insecticides and things like that. So, you know, we're really interested in more than just big tech, but big tech is extremely important. And it's important for us to be taking a look at it because, like you were saying in your lead-in, there isn't a regulator for big tech in the United States.
The lawsuit against Apple mentions the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice case against Microsoft. This is back in the 1990s, I think it was. And some people have made the case that, ironically, that helped pave the way for Apple to grow once that lawsuit came through. Can you talk about that precedent and how you see it shaping this current legal challenge against Apple?
Well, first, I will give everyone a history lesson. Wisconsin was extremely important in that Microsoft case. My predecessor as Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust, Kevin O'Connor, was one of the leaders on the state side for the Microsoft case, right? So we have a long history with that case. I would say, like you said, the success of the Microsoft lawsuit did actually pave the way for Apple. you know, because it reduced Microsoft's dominance, whether we're really going to look at that as a litigation playbook, you know, times have changed and we have more recent experience, certainly from the Google case we just tried last fall. So I think we're going to look to use that experience, certainly look at what the court ruled in the Microsoft decision and all of these tech cases.
Talking to Gwendolyn Cooley, Assistant Attorney General at the Wisconsin Department of Justice, looking at a multi-state and federal lawsuit against Apple for anti-competitive behavior using some of their market power to unfairly, the allegations go, limit competition to make things difficult for app providers, ultimately hurt consumers. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. What is the timeline, Gwendolyn, on this case? When are we expecting this to hit the courts? I know these things can run on for a long while.
Yes, they like we were just saying, the Google search case was a fast antitrust case because it took 4 years. We have hit the courts, right? We filed this complaint in New Jersey. It's before Judge Farbiage. We don't know what the timings are yet. He hasn't set a schedule. We'll be negotiating that over the next few months. Typically, we're seeing a kind of 2-4 year timeline for when a trial is set on these cases. So we will wait and see what the judge decides. Often we will negotiate with the other side and kind of come up with a timeline and then present that to the judge and see what works best for his schedule in this case.
Let's go back to our callers. Jeff is with us in Onalaska. Jeff, hi.
Hey there. I'm just wondering, are we focusing on big tech because they have deep pockets? Seems like we could be doing a lot more of antitrust related agriculture and how that consolidation is driving up prices at the grocery stores. So yeah, tech can affect people and how much they pay for a new iPhone. But when you go buy a gallon of milk or when you buy food at the grocery store, it can be affected more so by these antitrust than the fact that we're not looking at prosecuting the antitrust that's going on or the consolidation that's going on in ag.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Gwendolyn, you mentioned some other industries, the drug companies and others that might be pesticides, that might be targets of antitrust action. How about some heavily concentrated parts of the food supply chain?
So I think our caller, Jeff, is correct, right? Big tech is important. None of the cases, with the exception of the Google in-app payments case, none of the cases are money cases. They're not deep pockets. They're about getting injunctions so that they're competing better. Okay. As far as agriculture goes, I absolutely agree. Agriculture, in my time as chair of the NAG Antitrust Task Force, that has been one of the things that has been most important to me. Obviously, agriculture extremely important to the state of Wisconsin. Attorney General Call, and I staffed the case, challenged the second Dean Foods merger. I've actually challenged their mergers twice because we were trying to protect Wisconsin's dairy industry and make sure that, for example, dairy farmers had an opportunity to have a place to send their milk that wasn't a complete monopoly in the state of Wisconsin. So, you know, we challenged that merger. We got some divestitures of two plants, one in De Pere and one just outside of Wisconsin over the Illinois border. Extremely important industry. Like I said, we've currently got the pesticides case going on. We actually have been working with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and received a grant. The multi-state group has received a grant to continue to prosecute cases in the agriculture space. It's extremely important. Grocery stores, you mentioned. I will just say, typically the way that we look at mergers are whether there's head-to-head overlap in mergers. And a number of states are challenging the Albertson-Kroger merger. And one of the concerns that those states have is the increase in grocery prices that have gone up 25% in the last few years. So I absolutely agree. Agriculture is extremely important, and we're continuing to work hard at that, right? I'm here to talk about this one big tech case, but we've got an assortment of cases, including, in particular, agriculture. It's so important.
Jeff, thanks for that call. Gwendolyn, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Gwendolyn Cooley, Assistant Attorney General at the Wisconsin Department of Justice and Chair of the National Association of Attorneys General Multi-State Antitrust Task Force. We've been talking about the U.S. Department of Justice's lawsuit against Apple, why Wisconsin's Justice Department has joined that case, and what it can mean for consumers along the way. Yesterday on the show, we invited you to share your favorite board games and other games. A lot of you called in with yours. Got a couple more emails, too. Jeremy from West Bend writes, for board games, absolutely love Twilight Imperium with the Prophecy of Kings expansion. It's a 6 to 12 hour space opera with 25 playable factions. It can be hard to get to the table, worth the day playing. I played a different version of that. Yeah, it's a monster. Set aside a day. Card games, Jeremy says, Sheep's Head. John wrote in with a card game, 15-2, 15-4, Say No More. I say Ain't No More. A Cribbage. And Kate Sullivan here at Wisconsin Public Media says, my daughter and I have an ongoing backgammon series. Sometimes take our portable magnetic board to the terrace or Lombardino's bar. It's fun to play amid the hubbub and sip a beverage. Kate also says, a Quiddler and Rummy Cup. Keep sending your game stories in. Email ideas at WPR.org. Some people say Rummy Cube or Rummy Cube. I say Rummy Cub. I don't know. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, two hospitals closed in western Wisconsin last week. We check in on how these closures could affect patients and the state of rural health care. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a rivalry between the popular advice columnists Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren.
Legendary advice columnist Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren dished out wise and witty advice to millions of readers for more than half a century. The two were also twins and sometimes bitter rivals. But before they were famous, they lived in Eau Claire, Wisconsin for more than a decade. Dean Robbins brings you the story of the sisters who perhaps could have used some advice themselves.
Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren were America's leading advice columnists from the 1950s into the 21st century. Dear Abby was the world's most widely syndicated newspaper column with 110 million readers. Ask Ann Landers wasn't far behind with 90 million. Each writer solved other people's problems, answering letters with homespun wisdom. However, their own problems with each other proved harder to solve. Anne and Abby became bitter professional rivals, but once upon a time, they were inseparable twin sisters, raising families a mile away from each other in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Born Pauline and Eppie Friedman in Sioux City, Iowa in 1918, they grew up doing everything together. They even had a double wedding in identical dresses and veils. In the 1940s, the twins moved to Eau Claire, where both of their husbands had jobs at the National Presto Appliance Company. Pauline and Eppie cut glamorous figures in their new community. They hosted elaborate parties, volunteered for local charities, and led parades in a Cadillac convertible. They also loved to watch the Eau Claire Bears baseball team at Carson Park, turning heads with their lacquered hairstyles. But by the end of their decade in Eau Claire, cracks appeared in the sisters' relationship. Pauline and her millionaire husband lived in a stately two-story, while Eppie and her poorer husband had a small two-bedroom that Pauline dubbed Peanut Place. They even began trading insults about each other's daughters. The stage was set for a blow-up, and it happened shortly after the twins left Eau Claire in 1954. First, Eppie took over the Ann Landers advice column at the Chicago Sun-Times. A mere 3 months later, Pauline jumped into the advice biz herself, starting Dear Abby under the pen name Abigail Van Buren at the San Francisco Chronicle. Eppie saw it as a hostile gesture, and the sisters stopped speaking. In 1958, a Life magazine article gave them a national platform for their quarrel. She wanted to be the first violin in the school orchestra, Pauline sneered, but I was. Eppie retorted, she's just like a kid who beats a dog until somebody looks and then starts petting it. Ouch. The magazine declared it the most feverish female feud since Elizabeth sent Mary, Queen of Scots, to the chopping block. The dueling advice columnists reconciled in 1964, but hard feelings remained. In a 1979 TV appearance, Eppie claimed she never read Dear Abby. In a magazine interview 2 years later, Pauline mocked Eppie as envious and inferior. For good measure, she said her twin looked old. Ouch again. Eppie died in 2002 and Pauline in 2013, concluding the saga of Ann Landers versus Abigail Van Buren. You have to wonder if, at the end of their lives, they pined for the innocent pleasures of Eau Claire. Yes, both had become wildly successful since their time in Wisconsin, hailed as America's most influential women. But would they have traded all that to be back in Carson Park, arm in arm, blissfully cheering the Bears baseball team?
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
This is Central Time. Two hospitals in western Wisconsin officially closed late last week. They were operated by Hospital Sisters Health System, or HSHS. The health system cited, quote, prolonged financial and operational stress, end quote, as the reason for the closures. HSHS partner Previa Health is also withdrawing from western Wisconsin, with over a dozen clinics closing in that part of the state. Hospitals serving rural populations have been struggling for years. In 2023, half of all rural hospitals in the U.S. were losing money. We're talking about the closure of these hospitals and clinics and the state of rural health care across the country, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're in that area around Eau Claire, are you directly affected by the closure of these hospitals and clinics as a patient or someone who worked there? What does this mean for you next? What are you looking at? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Lee Driesang is a family medicine doctor at UW Health and a professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Driesang, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me. Great to have this opportunity to speak with you.
The first worry, of course, I imagine, is for people who relied on these hospitals and clinics for their daily and or emergency health care. What do we know about how closures like this are going to affect people in that community, Dr. Driesang?
Well, absolutely. This is terrible news. And we know that as the nearest hospital gets farther and farther away, that outcomes in terms of morbidity, mortality even, and just the general health of rural communities is negatively affected in really significant ways.
And I know other hospitals in the area, other clinics in the area are trying to staff up some, expand their operations. I imagine that's not the sort of thing you can do overnight. What do you see as the challenges of those remaining institutions trying to deal with hopefully providing service to the people who lost it?
Right. It is going to be hard. One example is attending deliveries. And so the HSHS Sacred Heart Hospital attended about 800 deliveries per year. Marshfield and Mayo are two other systems still in the area, but Marshfield, I guess, has four OB beds, and Mayo has a few more, but there's no way enough between the two to cover the closure. And so they'll need to build up hospitals, and people will need to travel, and I'm sure there are going to be some really tragic consequences as a result.
Now, we've seen in the last couple decades a lot of rural hospitals closing around the country. A stat from the University of North Carolina says that's about 200 hospitals. What are some of the challenges, especially in either rural areas or areas around small cities like Eau Claire? Why is it harder to keep hospitals up and running?
Every place has its own combination of reasons, and reasons are bigger or smaller in individual cases. But I'll run through a number of the causes of rural hospital closures, and then we can talk in more detail about some of them if you like. One is not having enough patient volume to support services. Another is a bad payer mix with low payments due to large percentage of Medicaid or uninsured patients. A third factor, particularly relevant to Wisconsin, is that Wisconsin is one of a small handful of states which has not accepted free money on the table in terms of expansion of Medicaid, and that particularly hits rural hospitals and rural areas. Medicare Advantage has had a negative impact on rural areas. There's also a loss of physician, nurses, and other essential staff due to burnout, poor pay, poor working conditions, et cetera. A number of rural hospitals have the wrong mix of physicians, too many subspecialists who can't share work and interchangeably, they can't cover for each other, and too few full-scope family medicine physicians who can cover all care and share call and create a viable long-term physician workforce. There's difficulty in recruiting essential staff because of geography or lack of community amenities, poor reputations of schools, et cetera. Poor community support, sometimes where people bypass local care, and a lack of tax support sometimes, aging outdated facilities, and some administrative problems in terms of trying to run a rural hospital like an urban hospital with too much spent on subspecialty care to the neglect of primary care, and some financial mismanagement sometimes in collecting procedures, or in some cases, even frank fraud.
Wow. That is a huge list, Dr. Driesang. Let me point in the other direction. Do you see some successful strategies, given that laundry list of challenges facing a rural hospital? Do you see what ways a light at the end of the tunnel for some that can point a way forward?
Yes, and I think family practice is a key solution. And family physicians can cover all parts of the hospital, and in lower volume areas, they're able to sustain a practice, whereas a specialist may not have enough patients in their area to sustain a practice. And then they can cover call for each other and give each other a lifestyle that is reasonable. I think another big one for Wisconsin that's an easy answer is to accept the Medicaid expansion dollars, and that would be a big boost of revenue and help quite a bit. Those are a couple of easy answers. I guess here in Madison, I'm excited to say that we are working collaboration with the UW Family Medicine and Obstetric Departments to increase rural pregnancy care workforce in the state, and working towards developing a rural family medicine OB surgical fellowship, which is scheduled likely to open and take our first fellow in July of 2025. La Crosse just opened a family medicine OB fellowship this year, and it will accept their first fellowship fellow in this July, so some efforts to build the workforce there. I think there could be investments in incentive programs to attract physicians who will commit to staying in the area for a while. Usually once physicians go to an area, they'll love it and are more likely to stay. So some loan forgiveness programs like the modeled after the National Health Service Corps, which I did myself when I got out of medical school and training and residency. So I guess those are a few steps that can be taken. There can be efforts to opening some hospitals that have closed. Chatham, North Carolina recently did this successfully and could be looked at as a national model.
Talking to Dr. Lee Driesang, professor of the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health, talking about hospital and clinic closures in western Wisconsin. Big news there over the last week. And the challenges facing smaller hospitals, rural hospitals in general. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have to drive a long way to see a doctor or a medical specialist? Do you live far away from a hospital or emergency room? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to UW Health Family Medicine Dr. Lee Driesang about the closure of two hospitals and over a dozen clinics in western Wisconsin and the challenges of providing care, especially in rural areas. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences, especially if those closures affected you. 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Sue is with us in Eau Claire. Sue, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a couple of things to add to what's been presented so far. One of them is there's a lot of nurse practitioners in Wisconsin who are looking for the opportunity to have an independent practice. Governor Evers is not signing that bill right now, although it's been passed by both the Senate and the Assembly, and there doesn't seem to be any reason why. Nurse practitioners can take the place of the family practice docs, because I have for years. A second thing is there's a lot of integrative therapies that have been taught as part of the required curriculum at several of the schools of nursing here in Wisconsin, including when I was teaching at UW-Eau Claire. Those integrative therapies can be very valuable for pain management, preventing secondary infections, such as with a Foley catheter when that's removed for urine retention. And there's ways that can be done that prevent having to insert a catheter a second time and causing a bladder infection. There's different integrative therapies with wound healing.
I'm going to jump in. We don't have a ton of time left. Dr. Driesang, Sue's thoughts on one on nurse practitioners. This legislation still waiting potentially for a signature. Do you see that as maybe part of a solution to practitioner shortages in rural areas?
Yes, I think collaboration between all different providers, including nurse practitioners and family physicians, physician assistants, and everybody's needed. And historically, family physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs are some of the classes of providers who've been more willing and able to work in rural areas and stay long term and meet the needs. It's harder for specialists, other specialties to sustain a practice in a rural area, both in terms of the volume not being enough when you're not doing some of everything, and coverage issues to be able to cover call for others. It's harder when you've got a more narrow focus in a rural area.
Sue, thanks a lot for the call. Sherry joins us now in Eau Claire. Sherry, hello.
Hey.
Yeah, go ahead, Sherry.
Yes, my brother-in-law has stage 4 bone cancer and prostate cancer and was attending HSHS hospital and doctors. And now the Marshfield Hospital, which is like across the parking lot from Sacred Heart, will not take him as a patient. And another option, downtown Eau Claire, Luther Hospital, Middleford, they will not accept him either.
Sherry, you're breaking up, but I think we got your point. Dr. Driesang, somebody with needing serious treatment and follow-ups with bone and prostate cancer, lost that coverage at a hospital there, and others not taking them. Is this something that we are going to see a lot of, do you think?
Yes, unfortunately, I think we are. And, you know, part of why HSHS was perhaps not able to thrive in the Western central Wisconsin areas that they were did have a mission and were willing to take on patients with more complex health needs and with lower resources. And so I think it's going to be essential for the existing health facilities, Marshfield and Mayo, to really step up, and because there are a lot of patients with big needs, financial and health needs, that are going to need care. And then additionally, hopefully the state and others will be able to provide some extra support. But I think there are a large number of people that are in really a terrible situation with these closures.
Sherry, thanks for the call. I hope your brother-in-law finds the treatment he needs. Last time, Dr. Driesang, we talked about these hospital closures. We heard from Bethany and Durand, who's directly affected by this. I want to give a listen to part of her call.
So I have two children who have traumatic brain injuries, and it is critical that they receive speech therapy, physical and occupational therapy. And Prevea in Eau Claire was the only pediatric one in the area, and now that's closing. Services that are so essential to pediatrics. And so now I'm having to look at driving all the way to La Crosse if I can find and get on the waiting list and find someone that will take their insurance, their Forward Health, or I have to go all the way to Hudson. It's a really a critical piece that I really wish they would address in the Eau Claire area, the need for pediatric services.
Bethany bringing up a treatment for kids getting lost in the shuffle and chronic care for kids. Dr. Driesang, your thoughts on that predicament in Western Wisconsin just in our last minute or so?
Being able to open some more clinics will really help with the pediatric patients and those with extra needs. One model in Lafarge, there's a Center for Special Children where they're able to provide services locally and then bring in specialists and therapists to provide those extra services. I think some of the needs, maybe telemedicine can come in, but for some of the hands-on physical therapy and other needs, that's not going to do. So hopefully there can be some reopening of an expansion of services of what's left after the closures, because it's not going to be enough.
Dr. Driesang, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Dr. Lee Driesang, family medicine doctor at UW Health and professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked to us about the closure of two hospitals, over a dozen primary and specialty care clinics in Western Wisconsin, and the challenges facing hospitals and healthcare in smaller communities around the state. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the U.S. Supreme Court heard a case challenging a key pill used in medication abortions. The outcome could have an impact on many FDA-regulated drugs. We'll dig into the case and the issues raised this week before the court. And babysitting was a time-honored tradition for American teens over the generations, but it seems to be on the decline. Is it the end of the era of the babysitter? Join the conversation. Maybe share your experiences. Did you grow up babysitting when you were younger? Do you see that happening less often in the next generation? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.